Gregory's arms and Peter's body, and swarming blotches of black and white moved over them for a second. Still howling, Bait threw Peter into the screen. Ricky could not see his knife and went on his knees to scrabble for it. His fingers closed around a bone handle, and a long blade reflected a line of gray light. Fenny thrashed beside him, rolling over onto his hand and uttering a thin, "Eee!" dead air, rushing out. Ricky snatched the knife from under Fenny's back, feeling his hand come away wet, and made himself stand. Gregory Bait was just scrambling up onto the stage to leap through the rip in the screen after Peter, and Ricky threw out his free hand and grasped the thick collar of his pea jacket. Bait suddenly went rigid, his reflexes as good as a cat's, and Ricky knew in terror that he would kill him. Spinning around with pulverizing hands and slashing teeth, if he did not do the only possible thing. Before Bait could move, Ricky slammed the bowie knife into his back. Now he could hear nothing, not the noises on the soundtrack, not the cry that must have come from Bait. He stood still, gripping the bone handle, deafened by the enormity of what he had done. Bait fell back down and turned around and showed Ricky Hawthorne a face to carry with him all his life, eyes full of tearing wind and blizzard, and a black mouth open as wide as a cavern.
"Filth," Ricky said, almost sobbing.
Bait fell toward him. Don climbed over the seats carrying the axe, in a desperate hurry to get to Bait before he could tear open Ricky's throat. Then he saw the muscular body slump, and Ricky, gasping, pushing him off. Bait fell back into the front of the stage and went to his knees, fluid dribbling from his mouth.
"Get away, Ricky," Don said,
but the old lawyer was unable to move. Bait began to crawl toward him. He stepped beside Ricky, and Bait tilted back his head and looked straight into his eyes.
"Live forever."
Don hurriedly raised the axe over his head and brought the sharpened blade down into Bait's neck, cutting down deeply into the chest. With the next blow, he severed the head. Peter Barnes crawled back out through the screen, dazzled by pain and the beam from the projector. He made himself move across the few feet of bare wood to the edge of the stage, hearing a wild shrieking of voices, thinking that if he could get to the bowie knife before Gregory Bait saw him, he might at least be able to save Don. Ricky had been killed by the first blow he knew. He had seen its force. Then the beam of light slipped over his head, and he saw what Don was doing. Gregory Bait, headless, squirmed under the blows of the axe. Beside him, Fenny rolled helplessly back and forth, covered in moving white pulp.
"Let me,"
he said, and both Ricky and Don stared up at him with white faces. When Peter was down on the floor of the theater beside them, he took the axe from Don and brought it weakly, glancingly down, his hysteria and loathing spoiling the blow. Then he felt suddenly strong as a logger, felt as if he were glowing, filled with light, and raised it effortlessly, all the pain leaving him, and brought the axe down again, and again, and again, and then moved to Fenny. When they were only shreds of skin and smashed bones, a zero breeze lifted off their ruined bodies and swirled up into the beam from the projector, passing Peter with such force that it knocked him aside. Peter bent down into the mess and picked up the bowie knife.
"By God," Ricky said,
and tottered into one of the seats. When they left the theater, limping, their minds numb, they felt an impatient, hurrying wind, even in the lobby. A wind that seemed to swirl through the empty space,
rattling posters in the bag of potato chips on the candy counter, searching the way out. And when they broke open the doors, it streamed over them to join the worst blizzard of the season. 15. Don and Peter half-carried Ricky Hawthorne home through the storm, and now there were two convalescents in the Hawthorne home. Peter explained it to his father like this.
"I'm staying with Mr. and Mrs. Hawthorne, Dad. I'm stuck at their house. Don Wanderley and I had to practically bring Mr. Hawthorne home on a stretcher. He's in bed, and so is she, because she feels bad after a little accident in her car."
"There'll be a lot of accidents on the roads this afternoon," his father said.
"And we finally got a doctor to come give her a sedative. And Mr. Hawthorne has a terrible cold. The doctor said could turn into pneumonia if he doesn't rest. So Don Wanderley and I are taking care of them both."
"Let me get this straight, Pete. You were with this Wanderley and Mr. Hawthorne?"
"That's right," Peter said.
"Well, I wish you'd thought of calling before this. I was worried half to death. You're all I have, you know."
"I'm sorry, Dad."
"Well, at least you're with good people. Try to get home when you can, but don't take any chances in the storm."
"Okay, Dad," Peter said, and hung up,
grateful that his father had sounded sober, and even more grateful that he had asked no more questions. He and Don made soup for Ricky and brought it up to the guest room where the old man was resting while his wife slept undisturbed in their bedroom.
"Don't know what happened to me," Ricky said. "I just couldn't move another step. If I'd been alone, I would have frozen to death out there."
"If any of us had been alone," Don said, and did not have to finish the sentence.
"Or if there had been only two of us," Peter said, "we'd be dead. He could have killed us easily." "Yes, well, he didn't," Ricky said briskly. "Don was right about them, and now 2/3 of what we have to do is accomplished."
"You mean we have to find her?" Peter said. "Do you think we can do it?"
"We'll do it," Don said. "Stella might be able to tell us something. She might have learned something, heard something. I don't think there's any doubt that the man in the blue car was the same man who was after you. We should be able to talk to her tonight."
"Will it do any good?" Peter asked. "We're snowed in again. We'll never be able to drive anywhere, even if Mrs. Hawthorne does know something."
"Then we'll walk," Don said.
"Yes," Ricky said. "If that's what it takes, we'll walk."
And lay back against the pillows.
"You know, we're the Chowder Society now, the three of us. After Sears was found dead, I said I was the only one left. I felt terribly bereft. Sears was my best friend. He was like my brother, and I'll miss him as long as I live. But I know that when Gregory Bate cornered Sears, Sears put up a hell of a good scrap. He did his best to save Fenny once a long time ago, and I know he did his best against them when his time came. No, there's no need to feel bad about Sears. He probably did better than any of us could have done alone."
Ricky put his empty soup bowl down on the bedside table.
"But now there's a new Chowder Society, and here we all are. And there's no whiskey and no cigars, and we're not dressed right. And, good heavens, look at me. I'm not even wearing a bow tie."
He plucked at the open collar of his pajama shirt and smiled at them.
"And I'll tell you one other thing.
No more awful stories, and no nightmares either. Thank God.
I'm not so sure about the nightmares, Peter said.
After Peter Burns went off to his own room to lie down for an hour, Ricky sat up in bed and looked candidly at Don Wanderley through his glasses.
Don, when you first came here, you saw that I didn't like you very much. I didn't like you being here. And until I saw that you were like your uncle in certain ways, I didn't much take to you personally. But I don't have to tell you that's all changed, do I? Good Lord, I'm chattering away like a magpie. What was in that shot the doctor gave me, anyhow?
A huge dose of vitamins.
Well, I feel much better. All revved up. I still have that terrific cold, of course, but I've had that so long that it feels like a friend. But listen here, Don. After what we've been through, I couldn't feel closer to you. If Sears felt like my brother, you feel like my son. Closer than my son, in fact. My boy Robert can't talk to me. I can't talk to him. That's been true since he was about 14. So I think I'm going to adopt you spiritually, if you don't object.
It makes me too proud of myself to object, Don said, and took Ricky's hand.
You sure there were just vitamins in that shot?
Well, if this is how dope makes you feel, I can understand how John became an addict. He lay back and closed his eyes.
When all this is over, assuming we're still alive, let's stay in touch. I'll take Stella on a trip to Europe. I'll send you a barrage of postcards.
Of course, Don said, and started to say something, but Ricky was already asleep. Shortly after 10 o'clock, Peter and Don, who had eaten downstairs, brought a grilled steak, a salad, and a bottle of burgundy up to Ricky's room. Another plate on the tray held a second steak for Stella. Don knocked on the door, heard Ricky say, "Come in," and entered, carrying the heavy tray. Stella Hawthorne, her hair in a scarf, looked up at Don from beside her husband on the guest room bed.
"I woke up an hour or so ago," she said, "and I got lonely, so I came down here to Ricky." "Is that food? Oh, you're lovely, both of you." She smiled at Peter, who was standing shyly in the door. "While the two of you were eating us out of house and home, I had a little talk with Stella," Ricky said. He took the tray and put it on Stella's lap, and then removed one of the plates.
"What luxury this is. Stella, we should have had maids years ago."
"I think I mentioned that once," Stella said.
Though still obviously shaken and exhausted by shock, Stella had improved enormously during the evening. She did not look like a woman in her 40s now, and perhaps she never would again, but her eyes were clear. Ricky poured wine for himself and Stella and cut off a piece of steak.
"There's no doubt that the man who picked up Stella was the same one who followed you, Peter. He even told Stella that he was a Jehovah's Witness."
"But he was dead," Stella said, and for a moment the shock swept wholly back into her face. She snatched at Ricky's hand and held it.
"He was."
"I know," Ricky said, and turned to the other two again.
"But after she came back with help, the body was gone." "Will you please tell me what is going on?" Stella said, now almost in tears. "I will," Ricky said, "but not now. We're not finished yet. I'll explain everything to you this summer, when we get out of Millburn."
"Out of Millburn?"
"I'm going to take you to France. We'll go to Antibes
and Saint-Tropez and Arles and anywhere else that looks good. We'll be a pair of funny-looking old tourists together. But first, you have to help us. Is that all right with you?" Stella's practicality saw her through. "It is, if you're really promising and not just bribing me."
"Did you see anything else around the car when you came back with Leon Churchill?" Don asked.
"No one else was there," Stella replied, calmer again.
"I don't mean another person. Any animals?"
"I don't remember. I felt so sort of unreal." "No, nothing."
"You're sure? Try to remember how it looked. The car, the open door, the snowbank you hit."
"Oh," she said,
and Ricky paused with the fork halfway to his mouth.
"You're right. I saw a dog."
"Why is that important?"
"It jumped on top of the snowbank from someone's yard, and then jumped down onto the street. I noticed it because it was so beautiful. White."
"That's it," Don said. Peter Barnes looked back and forth from Don to Ricky, his mouth open.
"Wouldn't you like some wine, Peter? And you, Don?" Ricky asked.
Don shook his head, but Peter said,
"Sure,"
and Ricky passed him his glass. "Can you remember anything the man said?"
"It was all so horrible. I thought he was crazy. And then I thought he knew me because he called me by name, and he said I shouldn't go to Montgomery Street because you weren't there anymore."
"Where were you?"
"I'll tell you all about it over a Pernod this spring."
"Anything else you remember?" Don asked. "Did he say where he was taking you?"
"To a friend," Stella said, and shuddered. "He said I'd see a mystery, and he talked about Lewis."
"Nothing more about where his friend was?"
"No, wait. No."
She looked down at her plate and pushed the tray down toward the foot of the bed.
"Poor Lewis. That's enough questions, please."
"You'd better leave us," Ricky said.
Peter and Don were at the door when Stella said,
"I remember. He said he was taking me to the Hollow. I'm sure he said that."
"That's enough for now," Ricky said.
"See you in the morning, gentlemen."
And in the morning, Peter and Don were startled to find Ricky Hawthorne already in the kitchen when they came down. He was scrambling eggs, pausing now and then to blow his nose into Kleenex from a convenient box.
"Good morning. Do you want to help me think about the Hollow?"
"You ought to be in bed," Don said.
"Like the dickens I ought to be in bed. Can't you smell how close we're getting?"
"I can only smell eggs," Don said. "Peter, get some plates out of the cupboard."
"How many houses are there in the Hollow? 50? 60? No, more than that. And she's in one of them."
"In there waiting for us," Don said. And Peter, putting plates on the Hawthorne's kitchen table, paused and set the final plate down more slowly. "And we must have had 2 feet of snow last night. It's still snowing. You wouldn't call it a blizzard anymore, but we could easily have another blizzard by this afternoon. There's a snow emergency over most of the state. Do you want to hike over to the Hollow and knock on 50 or 60 doors?"
"No, I want us to think," Ricky said, and carried the pan of eggs to the table and spooned a portion onto each plate. "Let's get some bread in the toaster."
When everything was ready, toast and orange juice and coffee, the three of them ate breakfast, following Ricky's lead. He seemed vibrant, sitting at the table in his blue dressing gown, almost elated. And he had obviously been thinking a great deal about the Hollow and about Anna Mostyn.
"It's the one part of town we don't know well," Ricky said. "And that's why she's there. She doesn't want us to find her yet. Presumably she knows that her creatures are dead. For the moment, her plans have been delayed. She'll want reinforcements, either more like the Bates or more like herself. Stella got rid of the only other one around with a hatpin."
"How do you know he was the only other one?" Peter asked.
"Because I think we would have encountered any others if they were here." They ate in silence for a moment.
"So I think she's just holed up in a vacant building, most likely, until more of them arrive. She won't be expecting us. She'll think we won't be able to move in this snow."
"And she'll be vengeful," Don said.
"She might also be afraid."
Peter snapped his head up.
"Why do you say that?"
"Because I helped kill her once before. And I'll tell you something else. If we don't find her soon, everything we have done will be wasted. Stella and the three of us bought time for the whole town, but as soon as outside traffic gets in..."
Ricky bit into a piece of toast.
"Things will be even worse than before. She won't just be vengeful, she'll be rabid. Twice we've blocked her. So we'd better lay out everything we can come up with about the Hollow, and we'd better do it now."
"Wasn't it originally the place where the servants lived?" Peter asked. "Back when everybody had servants?"
"Yes," Ricky said.
"But there has to be more. I'm thinking of what she said on Don's tape. In the places of your dreams. We found one of those places, but I'm thinking that there must be another one, some place where we could have been lured if we hadn't found Gregory and Fenny at the Rialto. But I just can't think."
"Do you know anybody who lives there?" Don asked.
"Of course I do. I've lived here all my life. But I can't for the life of me see the connection."
"What did the Hollow used to be like?" Peter asked.
"In the old days."
"In the old days? Back when I was a boy, you mean? Oh, much different. Much nicer. It was a lot cleaner than it is now. A bit raffish. We used to think of it as the Bohemian section of town. There was a painter who lived in Millburn then, did magazine covers. He lived there, and he had a splendid white beard and wore a cape. He looked just the way we thought painters should look. Oh, we used to spend a lot of time down there. Used to be a bar with a jazz band. Lewis liked to go there. Had a little dance hall. Like Humphrey's place, but smaller and nicer."
"A band?" Peter asked, and Don too lifted his head.
"Oh, yes," Ricky said, not noticing their excitement. "Only a little 6-8-piece band. Pretty good for anything you'd hear out here in the sticks."
He picked up the plates and took them to the sink, ran hot water over them.
"Oh, Millburn was lovely in those days. We all used to walk for miles, down to the Hollow and back, hear some music, have a beer or two, take a hike out into the country."
His arms deep in soapy water, Ricky abruptly ceased all movement.
"Good Lord, I know. I know."
Still holding a soapy plate, he turned toward them.
"It was Edward. It was Edward, you see. We used to go down to see Edward in the Hollow. That was where he moved when he wanted his own apartment. I was in the YPSL. My father hated that."
Ricky dropped the plate and stepped unseeing over the shattered pieces.
"And the owner was one of our first black clients. The building's still there. The town council condemned it last spring, and it's supposed to be demolished next year. We got Edward that apartment.
Sears and I."
He wiped his hands on his dressing gown.
"That's it. I know that's it. Edward's apartment. The place of your dreams."
"Because Edward's apartment," Don began, knowing that the old man was right,
"was where Eva Galley died and our dreams began," Ricky said. "By God, we've got her."
16. They dressed in all the warm clothing Ricky had, putting on several layers of underclothes and two shirts. Ricky's shirts couldn't be buttoned over the other two, but they meant two more layers of trapped air, and then sweaters, two pairs of socks. Even Don managed to slide his feet into an old pair of Ricky's lace-up boots. For once, Ricky had a reason to be grateful for his attachment to his clothes.
"We have to live long enough to get there," he said,
sorting through a box of old wool scarves.
"We'll wrap some of these around our faces. It must be about 3/4 of a mile from here to the Hollow. Good thing this is a small town. When we were all in our 20s, we used to walk from this part of town down to Edward's apartment and back 2 or 3 times in one day."
"So you're sure you can find the place?" Peter asked.
"I'm reasonably sure," Ricky said. "Now, let's have a look at ourselves."
They looked like 3 snowmen, padded out with so many layers of clothing.
"Ah, hats. Well, I have a lot of hats."
He fitted a high fur hat over Peter's head, put a red hunting cap that must have been 1/2 century old on his own head, and told Don,
"This one was always a little big on me."
It was a soft green tweed, and it fitted Don perfectly.
"Got it to go fishing with John Jaffrey. Wore it once. Hated fishing."
He sneezed and wiped his nose with a peach tissue from his coat pocket.
"In those days, I always preferred hunting."
At first, Ricky's clothing kept them warm, and as they went through lightly falling snow in a hard, bright light, they walked past a few men attacking their driveways with shovels and snow blowers. Children in bright snowsuits played on the drifts, active blots of color in the dazzle of light from the snow. It was 5 degrees above zero, and the cold attacked the exposed sections of their faces, but they might have been 3 normal men out on a conventional errand, hunting strayed children or an open store. But even before the weather changed, walking was difficult for them. Their feet began to feel the cold first, and their legs tired from the effort of wading through the deep snow. They soon gave up the luxury of speech. It took too much energy. Their breath condensed on the heavy wool scarves, and the moisture turned cold and froze. Don knew that the temperature was dropping faster than he'd ever seen it. The snow came down harder. His fingers tingled in the gloves. Even his legs began to feel cold. And sometimes, when they turned a corner and looked down a street hidden by a long, wide drift peaked up 15 feet high, he thought the 3 of them resembled photographs of polar explorers, doomed, driven men with blackened lips and frozen skin, small figures in a rippling white landscape. Halfway to the Hollow, Don was sure that the temperature had reached several degrees below zero. His scarf had become a stiff mask over his face, varnished by his breath. Cold bit at his hands and feet. He and Peter and Ricky were just straggling past the square, lifting their feet out of deep snow and leaning forward to get distance on the next step. The tree the mayor and the deputies had set up in the square was visible only as scattered green branches protruding through a mountain of white. Clearing Main Street and Wheat Row, Omar Norris had buried it. By the time they reached the traffic lights, the brightness had left the air and the piled snow no longer sparkled. It seemed as gray as the air. Don looked up and saw thousands of flakes swirling between dense clouds. They were alone. Down Main Street, the tops of a few cars sat like inverted saucers on the drifts. All the buildings were closed. New snow spun around them. The air was darkening to black.
"Ricky?" he asked.
He tasted frozen wool. His cheekbones open to the air burned.
"Not far," Ricky gasped. "Keep on going. I'll make it."
"How are you doing, Peter?"
The boy peered out at Don from under the snow-crusted fur cap.
"You heard the boss. Keep on going."
The new snow at first fell harmlessly, no more an obstacle than the candy floss snowfall at the start of their trip. But by the time they had gone 3 blocks more in a building wind, Don's feet, now like 2 blocks of ice, painfully welded to his ankles, the new snow was unequivocally a storm, not falling vertically or spinning prettily, but sleeting down diagonally, at intervals coming in waves like a surf. It stung where it hit. Whenever they reached the end of one of the high curled drifts, snow came straight at them, following the currents of the wind, blasting into their chests and faces. Ricky fell down backward and sat up chest high in the snow like a doll. Peter bent down to offer him an arm. Don turned around to see if he could help and felt the snow-laden wind pound against his back. He called,
"Ricky,
just have to sit for a little."
He breathed deeply, and Don knew how the cold would be scraping against his throat, how it would chill his lungs.
"No more than 2-3 blocks, Ricky said. "God, my feet!"
"I just had a hell of a thought. What if she's not there?"
"She's there,"
Ricky said, and took Peter's hand and pulled himself up.
"It's there. Few more blocks."
When Don turned back into the storm, he could not see for a moment. Then he saw thousands of fast-moving particles of white veering toward him, so close together that they were like lines of force. Vast, semi-transparent sheets cut him off from Ricky and Peter. Only partially visible beside him, Ricky motioned him on. Don was never sure when they crossed into the hollow. In the storm, it was no different from the rest of Millburn. Perhaps the buildings seemed marginally shabbier. Perhaps fewer lights shone dimly in the depths of the rooms, seeming thousands of feet away. Once he had written in his journal that the area had a sepia 30s prettiness. That seemed unutterably remote now. All was dark gray, dirty brick and taped windows. But for the few dim lights flickering behind curtains, it seemed ominous and deserted. Don remembered other facile words he had written in his journal. "If trouble ever comes to Millburn, it won't start in the hollow." Trouble had come to Millburn, and here in the hollow, on a sunny day in mid-October 50 years before, it had started. The three of them stood in the weak light of a street lamp, Ricky Hawthorne tottering, squinting across the street at 3 identical high brick buildings. Even in the noises of the storm, Don could hear him breathing.
"Over there,"
Ricky said harshly.
"Which one?"
"Can't tell,"
Ricky said, and shook his head, causing a shower of snow to whirl off the red hunting cap.
"Just can't."
He peered up into the storm, pointed his face like a dog, the building on the right, then back to the building in the middle. He raised the hand which held his knife and used it to point at the windows on the 3rd floor. They were curtainless, and one was half open.
"There! Edward's apartment! Just there!"
The street lamp over them died, and light faded all about them. Don stared at the windows high up on the desolate building, half expecting to see a face appear there, beckoning toward them. Fear worse than the storm froze him.
finally happened, Ricky said. Storm blew down the power lines. You afraid of the dark?
The three of them floundered across the drifted street. 17. Don pushed open the building's front door, and the other two followed him into the vestibule. They pulled their scarves away from their faces, their breath steaming in the small, cold space. Peter brushed snow from his fur hat and the front of his coat. None of them spoke. Ricky leaned against the wall, looking almost too weak to climb the stairs. A dead light bulb hung over their heads.
Coats,
Don whispered, thinking that the sodden garments would slow them down. He laid the axe down in the dark, unbuttoned his coat, and dropped it on the floor. Then the scarf, stinking of wet wool. His chest and arms were still constricted by the tight sweaters, but at least the heaviest weight no longer pulled at his shoulders. Peter, too, removed his coat and helped Ricky with his. Don saw their white faces hovering before him and wondered if this was the last act. They had the weapons which had destroyed the Bate brothers, but the three of them were limp as rags. Ricky Hawthorne's eyes were closed. Thrown back, its muscles lax, his face was a death mask.
Ricky,
Don whispered.
A minute.
Ricky's hand trembled as he raised it to blow on his fingers. He inhaled, held the air for a long moment, exhaled.
Okay. You'd better go first. I'll bring up the rear.
Don bent down and picked up the axe. Behind him, Peter wiped the blade of the bowie knife against his sleeve. Don found the bottom step with his numb toe and climbed onto it. He glanced back. Ricky stood behind Peter, propping himself against the staircase wall. His eyes were closed again.
Mr. Hawthorne, do you want to stay down here?
Peter whispered.
Not on your life.
With the other two following him, Don crept up the first flight of steps. Once, three well-off young men just beginning their practices in law and medicine, and a preacher's son of 17, had gone up and down these stairs, each of them close to 20 in the century's 20s. And up these stairs had come the woman with whom they were infatuated, as he had been infatuated with Alma Mobley. He reached the second landing and peeked around the corner to the top of the last flight of stairs. With part of his mind, he wished to see an open door, an empty room, snow blowing unnoticed into an empty apartment. What he saw instead made him pull back. Peter looked over his shoulder and nodded. And finally Ricky appeared on the landing to look up at the door at the top of the stairs. A phosphorescent light spilled out from beneath the door, illuminating the landing and the walls a soft green. Silently, they came up the final set of stairs into the phosphorescent light.
On three,
Don whispered, and cradled his axe just below the head. Peter and Ricky nodded.
One, two.
Don gripped the top of the banister with his free hand.
Three.
They hit the door together and it broke open under their weight. Each of them heard a single distinct word, but the voice delivering it was different for each of them. The word was,
Hello.
18. Don Wanderley, caught in a huge dislocation, spun around at the sound of his brother's voice. Warm light fell around him. Traffic noises attacked him. His hands and feet were so cold that they might have been frostbitten, but it was summer. Summer. New York. He recognized the corner almost immediately. It was in the East 50s, and it was so familiar to him because quite near, somewhere very near, was a cafe with outdoor tables where he had met David for lunch whenever he was in New York. This was not a hallucination, not a mere hallucination. He was in New York, and it was summer. Don felt a weight in his left hand and, looking down, saw that he was carrying an axe. An axe? Now what? He dropped the axe as if it had jumped in his hand. His brother called, "Don, over here!" Yes, he had been carrying an axe. They had seen green light. He had been turning, moving fast. "Don!" He looked across the street and saw David, looking healthy and extremely prosperous, standing up at one of the outdoor tables, grinning at him and waving. David, in a crisp, lightweight blue suit, aviator glasses smoked over his eyes, their bows disappearing into David's sun-blonde hair. "Wake up!" his brother called over the traffic. Don rubbed his face with his freezing hands. It was important not to appear confused in front of David. David had asked him to lunch. David had something to tell him. New York? But yes, it was New York, and there was David, looking at him amusedly, happy to see him, full of something to say. Don looked down at the sidewalk. The axe was gone. He ran between the cars and embraced his brother and smelled cigars, good shampoo, Aramis cologne. He was here, and David was alive. "How do you feel?" David asked. "I'm not here, and you're dead," came out of his mouth. David looked embarrassed, then disguised it behind another smile. "You'd better sit down, little brother. You're not supposed to be talking like that anymore." David held his elbow and led him to a chair beneath one of the sun umbrellas. A martini on the rocks chilled a sweating glass. "I'm not supposed," Don began. He sat heavily in the chair. Manhattan traffic went down the pleasant East 50th Street. On the other side, over the top of the traffic, he read the name of a French restaurant painted in gold on dark glass. Even his cold feet could tell that the pavement was hot. "You bet you're not," David said. "I ordered steak for you, all right? I didn't think you'd want anything too rich." He looked sympathetically across the table at Don. The modish glasses hid his eyes, but David's whole handsome face exuded warmth. "Is that suit okay, by the way? I found it in your closet. Now that you're out of the hospital, you'll have to shop for some new clothes. Use my account at Brooks, will you?" Don looked down at what he wore. A tan summer suit, a brown and green striped tie, brown loafers. It all looked a little out of date and shabby beside David's elegance. "Now, look at me and tell me I'm dead," David said. "You're not dead," David sighed happily. "Okay, good. You had me worried there, pal. Now, do you remember anything about what happened?"
"No." "Hospital?"
"You had about the worst breakdown anyone's ever seen, brother. It was the next thing to a one-way ticket. Happened right after you finished that book."
"The Night Watcher?"
"What else? You just blanked out. And when you'd say anything, it was just crazy stuff about me being dead and Alma being something awful and mysterious. You were in outer space. If you don't remember any of this, it's because of the shock treatments. Now, we have to get you settled again. I talked to Professor Lieberman, and he says he'll give you another appointment in the fall. He really liked you, Don."
"Lieberman?" "No, he said I was..."
"That was before he knew how sick you were. Anyhow, I got you out of Mexico and put you in a private hospital in Riverdale. Paid all the bills until you got straightened out. The steak'll be here in a minute. Better get that martini down. The house red isn't bad here."
Don obediently sipped at his drink. That familiar, cold, potent taste. "Why am I so cold?" he asked David. "I'm frozen."
"After effect of the drug therapy," David patted his hand. "They told me you'd feel like that for a day or two, cold, not too sure of yourself yet? It'll go away, I promise you.
A waitress came with their food. Don let her take away his martini glass.
You had all these disturbed ideas, his brother was saying. Now that you're well again, they'll shock you. You thought my wife was some kind of monster who had killed me in Amsterdam. You were convinced of it. The doctor said you couldn't face the fact that you'd lost her. That's why you never came out here to talk about it. You wound up thinking that what you wrote in your novel was real. After you mailed the book off to your agent, you just sat in a hotel room, not eating, not washing. You didn't even get up to shit. I had to go all the way down to Mexico City to bring you back.
What was I doing an hour ago? Don asked.
You were getting a sedative shot. Then they put you in a cab and sent you down here. I thought you'd like to see the place again. Something familiar.
I've been in a hospital for a year?
Nearly 2 years. For the past few months, you've been making great progress.
Why can't I remember it?
Simple. Because you don't want to. As far as you're concerned, you were born 5 minutes ago. But it'll all come back slowly. You can recuperate at our place on the island. Lots of sun, sand, a few women. Like the sound of that?
Don blinked and looked around. His entire body felt unreasonably cold. A tall woman was just now coming down the block toward them, pulled along by an enormous sheepdog on a leash. The woman was slender and tanned. She wore sunglasses pushed up into her hair, and for a moment she was the emblem of what was real, the epitome of all not hallucinated or imagined, of sanity. She was no one important. She was a stranger. But if what David was telling him was the truth, she meant health.
You'll see plenty of women, David said, almost laughing. Don't burn your eyes out on the first one who crosses your path.
You're married to Alma now, Don said.
Of course. She's dying to see you.
And you know, David said, still smiling, holding a fork with a neatly speared section of meat.
She's kind of flattered about that book of yours. She feels she contributed to literature. But I want to tell you something, and David hitched his chair closer. Think about the consequences of it, if what you said in that book was true. If creatures like that really existed, and you thought they did, you know.
I know, Don said. I thought...
Wait, let me finish. Can't you see how puny we'd look to them? We live, a miserable 60, 70 years, maybe? They'd live for centuries, for a century of centuries, becoming anything they want to become. Our lives are made by accident, by coincidence, by a blind combination of genes. They make themselves by will. They would detest us. And they'd be right. Next to them, we would be detestable.
No, Don said. That's all wrong. They're savage and cruel. They live on death.
He felt as though he were about to be sick.
You can't say those things.
Your problem is that you're still caught up in the story you were telling yourself. Even though you're out of it, that story is still hanging around in your memory somewhere. You know, your doctor told me he never saw anything like it. When you flipped into a story. You'd be walking down the hall in the hospital, and you'd be carrying on a conversation with people who weren't there. You were all wrapped up in some sort of plot. Impressed the hell out of the doctors. You'd be talking to them, and they'd talk back, but you answered back like you were talking to some guy named Sears or another guy named Ricky.
David smiled and shook his head.
What happened at the end of the story? Don asked.
Huh?
What happened at the end of the story?
Don set down his fork and leaned forward, staring at his brother's bland face. They didn't let you get there, David said. They were afraid to. Looked like you were setting yourself up to get killed. See, that was part of your problem. You invented these fantastic, beautiful creatures, and then you wrote yourself into the story as their enemy. But nothing like that could ever be defeated. No matter how hard you tried, they'd always win in the end.
No, that isn't, Don said. That wasn't correct. You could only remember the vague outlines of the story David was talking about, but he was sure David was wrong. Your doctor said it was the most interesting way for a novelist to commit suicide they ever heard of. So they couldn't let you push it to the end, do you see? They had to bring you out of it.
Don sat as if in freezing wind.
Hello and welcome back, Sears said. We've all had that dream, but I imagine you must be the first to have it at one of our meetings.
What? Said Ricky, snapping up his head and seeing before him Sears's beloved library. The glass-fronted bookcases, the leather chairs drawn into a circle, the dark windows. Immediately across from him, Sears drew on his cigar and gazed at him with what looked like mild annoyance. Lewis and John, holding their whiskey glasses and dressed like Sears in black tie, appeared to be more embarrassed than annoyed.
"What dream?" Ricky said, and shook his head.
He, too, was in evening dress. By the cigar, by the quality of the darkness, by a thousand familiar details, he knew they were at the last stage of a Chowder Society meeting.
You dozed off, John said, right after you finished your story.
Story?
And then, Sears said, you looked right at me and said, you're dead.
Oh, the nightmare, Ricky said.
Oh, yes. Did I really? My goodness, I'm cold.
At our age, we all have poor circulation, said Dr. Jaffrey.
What's the date?
You really were out, Sears said, lifting his eyebrows. It's the 9th of October.
And is Don here? Where's Don?
Ricky looked frantically around the library, as if Edward's nephew might be hiding under a chair.
Really, Ricky, Sears grumped. We just voted on writing to him, if you remember. It is extremely unlikely that he should appear before the letter is written.
We have to tell him about Eva Galley, Ricky said, remembering the vote. It's imperative.
John smiled thinly, and Lewis leaned back in his chair, looking at Ricky as if he thought he'd lost his mind.
You do make the most amazing reversals, Sears said. Gentlemen, since our friend here evidently needs his sleep, perhaps we'd better call it a night.
Sears, Ricky said,
suddenly galvanized by another memory.
Yes, Ricky.
Next time we meet, when we meet at John's house, don't tell the story you have in mind. You cannot tell that story. It will have the most appalling consequences.
Stay here a moment, Ricky, Sears ordered, and showed the other two men out of the room. He came back carrying the freshly fired-up cigar and a bottle. You seem to need a drink. It must have been quite a dream.
Was I out long?
He could hear, down the street, the sound of Lewis trying to start up the Morgan.
10 minutes, no longer. Now, what was that about my story for next time?
Ricky opened his mouth, tried to recapture what had been so important only minutes before, and realized that he must look very foolish.
I don't know any more. Something about Eva Galley.
I can promise you I was not going to speak about that. I don't imagine any of us ever shall. And I think that really is for the best, don't you?
No. No. We have to...
Ricky realized he was going to mention Donald Wanderley again, and blushed.
I suppose it must have been part of my dream. Is my window open, Sears? I'm actually freezing, and I feel so tired. I can't imagine what
age, no more or less. We're coming to the end of our span, Ricky, all of us. We've lived long enough, haven't we?
Ricky shook his head.
John's dying already. You can see it in his face, can't you?
Yes, I thought I saw,
Ricky said, thinking back to a time at the start of the meeting, a plane of darkness sliding across John Jaffrey's forehead, which now seemed to have happened years before.
Death. That's what you thought you saw. It's true, my old friend.
Sears smiled benignly at him.
I've been giving this a lot of thought, and you mentioning Eva Galley. Well, it stirs it all up. I'll tell you what I have been thinking.
Sears drew on the cigar and leaned massively forward.
I think Edward did not die of natural causes. I think he was given a vision of such terrible and unearthly beauty that the shock to his poor mortal system killed him. I think we have been skirting the edges of that beauty in our stories for a year.
No, not beauty, Ricky said. Something obscene, something terrible.
Hold it. I want you to consider the possibility of another race of beings. Powerful, all-knowing, beautiful beings. If they existed, they would detest us. We would be cattle compared to them. They'd live for a century of centuries, so that you and I would look like children to them. They would not be bound by accident, coincidence, or a blind combination of genes. They'd be right to detest us. Beside them, we would be detestable.
Sears stood up, put down his glass, and began to pace.
Eva Galley. That was where we missed our chance. Ricky, we could have seen things worth our pathetic lives to see.
They're even vainer than we are, Sears, Ricky said. Oh, now I remember. The Bates. That's the story you can't tell.
Oh, that's all finished now, Sears said. Everything is finished now.
He walked to Ricky and leaned on his chair, looking down at him.
I fear that from now on all of us are... Is it or commerce or dacomba?
In your case, I'm sure it is or dacomba,
Ricky said, remembering his lines. He felt terribly ill, shivering. He felt the onslaught of the worst cold of his life. It lay like smoke in his lungs and weighted his arms like a winter's worth of snow.
Sears leaned toward him. That's true for all of us, Ricky. But still, it was quite a journey, wasn't it?
Sears plugged the cigar in his mouth and reached out to palp Ricky's neck.
I thought I saw swollen glands. You'll be lucky not to die of pneumonia.
Sears' massive hand circled Ricky's throat. Helplessly, Ricky sneezed.
Pay attention to me, David said. Do you understand the importance of this? You put yourself in a position where the only logical end is your death. So, although you consciously imagined these beings you invented as evil, unconsciously, you saw that they were superior. That's why your story was so dangerous. Unconsciously, according to your doctor, you saw that they were going to kill you. You invented something so superior to yourself that you wanted to give your life to them. That's dangerous stuff, kid.
Don shook his head. David put down his knife and fork.
Let's try an experiment. I can prove to you that you want to live, okay?
I know I want to live. He looked across the indisputably real street and saw the indisputably real woman walking up the other side, still tugged along by the sheepdog. No, not walking up the other side, he realized, but coming down it, as she had just come down his side. It was like a film in which the same extra is shown in different scenes, in different roles, jarring you with his presence, reminding you that this is only invention. Still, there she was, moving briskly behind the handsome dog, not an invention but part of the street. I'll prove it. I'm going to put my hands around your throat and choke you. When you want me to stop, just say stop. That's ridiculous. David reached quickly across the table and gripped his throat. Stop, he said. David tightened his muscles and went up off his chair, knocking the table aside. The carafe toppled and bubbled wine over the tablecloth. None of the other diners appeared to notice, but went on eating and talking in their indisputably real way, indisputably forking food into their indisputably real mouths. Stop, he tried to say, but now David's hands were bearing down too hard, and he could not form the word. David's face was that of a man writing a report or casting a fly. He knocked the table over with his hip. Then David's face was not his, but the head of an antlered stag, or the huge head of an owl, or both of those. Shockingly near, a man explosively sneezed.
"Hello, Peter. So, you want to look behind the scenes?"
Clark Mulligan backed away from the door of the projection room, inviting him in.
"Nice of you to bring him up, Mrs. Barnes. I don't get much company up here." "What's the matter? You look sort of confused, Pete."
Peter opened his mouth, closed it again.
"I..." "You could thank him, Peter," his mother said dryly.
"That movie probably shook him up," Mulligan said. "It has that effect on people. I've seen it hundreds of times by now, but it still gets me. That's all it was, Pete, a movie."
"A movie?" Peter said. "No, we were coming up the stairs."
He held out his hand and saw the bowie knife.
"That's where the reel ended. Your mother said you were interested in seeing how it all looks from up here. Since you're the only people in the theater, there's no harm in that, is there?"
"Peter, what in the world are you doing with that knife?" his mother asked. "Give it to me immediately." "No, I have to... I have to..."
Peter stepped away from his mother and looked confusedly around at the little projection booth. A corduroy coat draped from a hook, a calendar, a mimeographed piece of paper had been tacked to the rear wall. It was as cold as if Mulligan were showing the movie in the street.
"You'd better settle down, Pete," Mulligan said. "Now, here you can see our projectors. The last reel is all ready to go in this one, see? I get them all set up beforehand, and when a little mark shows up in a couple of the frames, I know I have so many seconds to start up the..."
"What happens at the end?" Peter asked. "I can't get straight in my head just what's..."
"Oh, they all die, of course," Mulligan said. "There's no other way for it to end, is there? When you compare them with what they're fighting, they really do seem sort of pathetic, don't they? They're just accidental little people, after all, and what they're fighting is, well, splendid, after all. You can watch the ending up here with me if you'd like. Is that okay with you, Mrs. Barnes?"
"He'd better," Christina said, sidling toward him. "He went into some kind of trance down there. Give me that knife, Peter."
Peter put the knife behind his back.
"Oh, he'll see it soon."